Drunk or not, I slept and slept and slept, and still when I awoke and the wonderful golden light suffused the room, I gazed up at, well, I suppose it was the ceiling, but the ceiling was so far up I could not tell where it was. It was truly an immense room, as if the whole wretched mountain was hollow. Sunlight, Lobsang, sunlight, and it will work 24 hours a day. The light it gives is absolutely without heat, it is precisely the same temperature as the air around us. Don't you think it is better to have light like this than smelly, smoking candles? I looked about again and just could not see how there could be sunlight when we were entombed in a rock room, and I said as much. The Lama replied, "Yes, this is a marvel of marvels, I have known it all my life, but no one knows how it works. Cold light is a miraculous invention, and this was invented or discovered a million or so years ago. They developed a method of storing sunlight, and making it available even on the darkest nights. There is none of it in the city nor in the temple because we just do not know how to make it. This is the only place I know where there is this type of lighting." "A million or so," you said. "That is almost beyond my comprehension. I think it is a figure like a 1 or a 2 or a 3, or something like that, followed by a number of noughts, 6 I think it is. But that's only a guess, and in any case it is so vast a number that I can't realize it. It doesn't count for anything for me. 10 years, 20 years, yes I can relate to that, but longer, no. How was this room made?" I asked as I trailed my fingers idly over some inscription on the wall. I jumped back in fright as a certain click occurred and a part of the wall slid back. "Lobsang. Lobsang. You have made a discovery. None of us who have been here knew there was another room attached to this." Cautiously we peered into the open doorway, and as soon as our heads passed the doorpost the light came on and I noted that as we left the first great room the light faded at our absence. We looked about almost afraid to move because we did not know what perils there were or what traps we might fall into, but eventually we plucked up courage and walked over to a great something standing in the middle of the floor. It was a tremendous structure. Once it had been shiny, but now it had a dull gray glaze. It was about 4 or 5 men tall, and it looked something like 2 dishes, one on top of the other. We walked around and there at the far side we saw a grey metal ladder extending down from a doorway in the machine to the floor. I ran forward forgetting that as a young man in holy orders I should show more decorum, but I ran forward and hastily climbed the ladder without even bothering to see if it was safely fixed. It was. Once again as my head blocked the doorway lights came on inside the machine. The Lama Minya donned up, not to be outdone, climbed up into the interior of the machine and said, "Ah, Lobsang, this is one of the chariots of the gods. You've seen them flitting about, haven't you?"
"Oh yes, sir," I replied. "I thought there were gods traversing our land to see that everything was all right, but, of course, I have never seen one as close as this before." Chapter 2. We looked about us and we seemed to be in a sort of corridor lined on both sides with lockers or closets, or something similar. Anyway, I pulled experimentally on a handle and a big drawer slid out as smoothly as if it had just been made. Inside there were all manner of strange devices. The Lama Minya donned up was peering over my shoulder. He picked up one of the pieces and said, "Ah. This will be spare parts. I have no doubt that these lockers contain spare parts enough to make this thing work again." We pushed the drawer shut, and moved on. The light moved ahead of us and dimmed as we passed, and soon we came to a large room. As we entered it became brilliantly illuminated, and we both gasped. This was obviously the control room of the thing, but what made us gasp was the fact that there were men about. One was sitting in what I imagined to be the control chair and he was peering at a meter on a board in front of him. There were quite a number of meters, and I surmised that he was just getting ready to take off. I said, "But how can these be millions of years old? These men look alive but soundly asleep." There was another man sitting at a table and he had some large charts in front of him. He had his head held between his hands and his elbows rested on the table. We spoke in whispers. It was awesome, and our science was nothing but mumbo jumbo compared to this. The Lama Minyadon Up caught hold of one of the figures by the shoulder, and said, "I think these men are in some form of suspended animation. I think they could be brought back to life, but I do not know how to do it. I do not know what would happen if I did know how to do it. As you know, Lobsang, there are other caves in this mountain range, and we visited one with strange implements in it, like ladders which, apparently, worked mechanically. But this beats anything I have seen so far, and as one of the senior lamas who is responsible for maintaining these intact, I can tell you that this one is the most wonderful of all, and wonder if there are any other knobs that we should press to open other rooms. But let us have a good look in this one first. We have about a week, because I think it will take at least that long before I am fit to climb down the mountainside." We went around looking at the other figures, seven of them in all, and they all gave the impression that they were ready to take off when something frightful occurred. It looked as if there had been an earthquake which toppled heavy rocks on what was probably a sliding roof. The lama stopped and approached another man who had a book, a notebook, in front of him. Obviously he had been writing the record of what was happening, but we could not read the writing. We had no basis for assuming that these are things were letters, ideographs, or even just technical symbols. The lama said, "In all our searches we have not found anything which would enable us to translate." "Wait a minute," he said with some unwanted excitement in his voice, "that thing over there, I wonder if that is a machine for speaking a record. Of course, I don't suppose that it will work after all these years, but we will try." Together we moved over to the instrument which he had mentioned. We saw it was a form of box, and about halfway down there was a line all the way around. Experimentally we pushed up on the surface above the line, and to our delight the box opened, and inside there were wheels and one thing which seemed to be for the conveyance of a metal strip from one spool to another. The Lama Minyadon Up peered down at the press buttons arrayed along the front. Suddenly we nearly jumped out of our skins. We nearly turned and ran for it, because a voice came from out of the top part of the box, a strange voice, much, much different from ours. It sounded like some foreigner lecturing, but what he was lecturing about we did not know. And then, surprise again, noises came out of the box, music I suppose they would call it, but to us it sounded all discords. So my guide pressed another button and the noise stopped. We were both rather exhausted with what we had discovered and by an excess of excitement, so we sat down on what were obviously chairs, and I felt panic because I seemed to sink right down in the chair as if I was actually sitting on air. As soon as we recovered from that shock, the Lama Minyadon Up said, "Perhaps we should have some tsampa to cheer us up, because I think both of us are exhausted." He looked about to see where we could light a little fire to warm up the tsampa, and he was soon rewarded, because there was a cubicle off the control room, and as he entered it the light came on. The lama said, "I think this must have been where they prepared their food, because all these buttons are not there for ornament, they are there for some useful purpose." He pointed to one button which had a picture of a hand held in the top position. Another button had a picture of flame, so he pushed the one with flame marked on it, and above that instrument there were various metal vessels. We took one down. By this time we were feeling heat, and the lama moved a hand about and finally said, "There you are, Lobsang, feel that, there is the heat for our cooking." I put my hand where he said, but a bit too close, and I jumped back in some alarm. But my guide just laughed and put near frozen tsampa in the metal container and then rested it on some bars over the hot thing underneath them. He added water, and soon we saw a little dribble of steam coming up from the dish with that he pressed the button marked with the hand symbol, and immediately the red glow ceased. He took the metal dish off the heat source, and with a metal thing with a big dish end he ladled tsampa into our bowls. For some time there was no sound other than the noise we made eating. With the tsampa finished I said, "I wish I could get a good drink, I am as thirsty as can possibly be." By the side of the box which made heat we saw what seemed to be a big basin, and above there were two metal handles. I tried one and turned it in the only way it would go, and water, cold water, gushed out into the basin. I hastily turned the handle back and tried the other one, which was of a reddish color. I turned that and really hot water came out, so much so that I scalded myself, not very seriously, but I still scalded myself enough to make me jump, so I turned that handle back to its original position. "Master," I said, "if this is water, it must have been here one of those millions of years that you talked about. How is it that we are able to drink it? It should be all evaporated or gone sour by now, but I find it quite pleasant." The Lama replied, "Well, water can be kept good for years. How about the lakes and the rivers? They were water far beyond history, and I suppose this water is from an airtight container, which means that it should stay palatable. I surmise that this ship had just come here for supplies, and perhaps for some repairs, because with the pressure of water that came out there must be quite a large amount in some storage tank. Anyway, we've got enough here to keep people busy for a month." I said, "Well, if the water kept fresh, there must be food here, perhaps that has kept fresh as well." I got up from the chair with some difficulty because it seemed to want to cling to me. But then I put my hands on the side of the chair, on the top of the armrests, and immediately I was not only released from the chair but I was shot up to a standing position. Having recovered from that marvel and shock, I went along feeling the walls in the little kitchen. I saw a lot of indentations which seemed to have no purpose. I put my finger in one and pulled, and nothing happened. I tried to pull it sideways, but no, the thing did not work. So I went to another one and I pushed my finger straight into the indentation and a panel slid aside. Inside that closet, or cabinet, or whatever the thing was called, there were a number of jars which seemed to be without any joins anywhere. There were transparent panels so that one could see what was inside. Obviously it was some sort of food, but how could food be preserved for a million years or more? I puzzled and puzzled over the problem. There were pictures of foods that I had never seen or heard of, and some of the things were encased in a transparent container, yet there seemed to be no way of opening the container. I went from one of these closets, cupboards, or storage rooms to another, and each time there was a fresh surprise. I knew what tea leaves were like, but here in one of the cabinets there were containers which I could see through the transparent sides contained tea leaves. There were other surprises because some of these transparent containers had what was obviously cuts of meat inside them. I had never tasted meat and I longed to have a go at it to see, or rather to taste, what it was like. I quickly tired of playing in the kitchen and I went in search of the Lama Minya Dondup. He had a book in his hand and he was frowning and in a state of intense concentration. "Oh, master," I said, "I have found where they keep their food. They have it stored in boxes that one can see through, but there is no way of opening them." He looked at me blankly for a moment and then burst out with a laugh. Oh yes," he said, "the packaging of the present-day materials is nothing like the packaging of a million years ago. I have tasted dinosaur meat and it was as fresh as if from a newly killed animal. I will come with you shortly and we will investigate." I walked around that control room and then I sat down to think things over. If these men were a million years old, why had they not crumbled into dust? It was clearly ridiculous to say that these men were a million years old when they were absolutely intact and appeared to be fully alive and just awaiting an awark ending. I saw that hung on the shoulders of each one there was a sort of small satchel, so I removed one from one of the sleeping bodies and I opened it. Inside there were curious bits of wire twisted in coils, and there were other things made of glass, and the whole thing made no sense at all to me. There was a rack inside full of buttons, press buttons, and I pressed the first one I saw. I screamed with fear. The body from which I had taken that satchel suddenly jerked and crumbled into fine, fine dust, the dust of a million years or more. The Lama Minya Dondup came over to where I stood petrified with fright. He looked at the satchel, and he looked at the pile of dust, and then he said, "There are quite a number of these caves. I have visited a few of them and we have learned never to press a button until you know what it does, until you have worked it out by theory." These men knew that they were going to be buried alive in some tremendous earthquake, so the doctor of the ship would have gone to each man and put a survival kit on his shoulder. The men would then go into a state of suspended animation so that they would know nothing whatever of what was happening to them or around them, they would be as near dead as anyone could be without AC to Ali dying. They would be receiving adequate nourishment to keep the body functioning on a minute scale. But when you touched this button, which I see as a red button, you would have discontinued the supply of life force to the man in suspended animation. Having no longer a life force supply, his age would come upon him suddenly, and he would immediately turn into a pile of dust. We went around to the other men and we decided that there was nothing we could do for them because, after all, we were shut in the mountain and the ship was shut in the mountain, and if these people came awake, would they be a danger to the world? Would they be a danger to the Lamazaris? These men, of course, were possessed of knowledge which would make them appear as gods to us, and we were afraid of being made into slaves again because we had a very strong racial memory that we had been slaves at some time. The Lama Minyadon up and I sat together on the floor, not speaking but each buried in his own thoughts. What would happen if we pressed this button, and what would happen if we pressed that button, and what sort of supply of energy could it be that would keep men alive and well nourished for more than a million years? Involuntarily we both shuddered at the same time, and then we looked at each other and the Lama said, "You are a young man, Lobsang, and I am an old man. I have seen much and I wonder what you would do in a case like this. These men are alive, there is no doubt about that, but if we bring them back to full life, what if they are savage, what if they kill us because we have let one of their number die? We have to think this over most seriously, we can't read the inscriptions." He stopped there because I had jumped to my feet in some excitement. "Master, master," I cried, "I have found a book which seems to be a sort of dictionary of different languages, I wonder if it would help us." Without waiting for a reply I jumped up and rushed into a room near the kitchen, and there was this book looking as if it had just been produced. I grabbed it with two hands because it was heavy, and then I dashed back to the Lama, my guide, with it. The Lama took the book and with ill-concealed suppressed excitement he opened the pages. For some time he sat there absolutely absorbed in the book. At last he became aware that I was jumping about in extreme agitation, wondering what it was and why he did not tell me. "Lobsang, Lobsang, I'm sorry, I apologize to you," said the Lama, "but this book is the key to everything, and what a fascinating tale it is. I can read it, it is written in what seems to be our honorific language. The average person, of course, could not read honorific Tibetan, but I can, and this ship is about 2 million years old. It works on energy obtained from light, any light of the stars, the light of the sun, and it picks up energy from those sources which have already used that energy and passed it on. These men," he referred again to the book, "were an evil lot. They were servants of the gardeners of the world. But it is the old tale, men and women, men want women just as women want men, but this ship was crewed by men who had abandoned the great moth worship, and this, actually, is what they term a lifeboat. The food would be quite safe to eat, and the men could be awakened, but no matter how long they have been here they are still renegades because they tried to find women who would be much too small for them and their association with the women would be an absolute torture to the latter. They wonder if their life satchels will work or whether it will have been switched off automatically from the ship which they refer to as the mothership. I think we shall have to experiment a bit and read some more because it seems clear to me that if these men are allowed to live then they have such knowledge that they can do us harm which we could never overcome because these people treat us as cattle, as things on which to carry out genetic experiments. Already they had done harm because of their sexual experiments with our women, but you are too young to know all about that yet." I wandered around the place. The Lama was lying down on the floor to ease his legs, which were giving quite a bit of trouble. I wandered around, and even to Ali I came to a room which was all green. There was a very peculiar looking table there with a great big light over it, and there were what appeared to be glass boxes all over the place. "HMM," I thought to myself, "this must be where they repair their sick people, I'd better go and tell the boss about this." So I bustled off and told the Lama Minyadon up that I had found a very peculiar room, a room that was all green and which had strange things encased in what looked like glass but wasn't. Slowly he got to his feet and with the help of the two staves made his way to the room I had discovered. As soon as I entered, I was leading the way, lights came on, lights just like daylight, and the Lama Minutes Jayadond up stood there in the doorway with a look of immense satisfaction on his face. "Well done, Lobsang, well done," he said. "That is two discoveries which you have made. I am sure this information will be well received by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama." He walked around looking at various things, picking up other things, and peering at the contents of some of the, well, I do not know what to call them. Some of the things in glass cubes were absolutely beyond my comprehension. But at last he sat down on a low chair, and he became enthralled in a book which he had taken from a shelf. "How is it," I asked, "that you can understand a language which you say is at least a million years old?" With an effort he put aside the book for a moment while he thought over my question. Then he said, "Well, it's quite a long tale, you know, Lobsang. It leads us back throughout the bylanes of history, it leads us through paths which even some of the lamas cannot follow. But briefly it is like this: this world was ready to be colonized and so our masters, I must call them masters because they were the head men of the gardeners of the earth and of other worlds, dictated that a certain species should be grown on the earth, and that certain species was us. In a far distant planet, right out of this universe, preparations were made and a special ship was made which could travel at an absolutely unbelievable speed, and we, as human embryos, were packed in the ship. Somehow the gardeners, as they were called, brought them to this world and then we do not know what happened between the time of the arrival of the embryos and the first creatures that could be called human. But during their absence from their home world much occurred. The old ruler, or god, was aged and there were certain people of evil intent who wanted his power, and they managed to get rid of that god and put another one, their own puppet, to rule in his place. His ruling, of course, to be dictated by these renegades. The ship came back from the earth and found things very different. They found they were not welcome and the new ruler wanted to kill them so they would be out of the way. But instead the gardeners who had just returned from the earth grabbed a few women of their own size and they took off again for the earth universe. There are many, many different universes, you know, Lobsang. Arrived at the world where they had been growing humans they set up their own dominion. They built various artifacts like pyramids with which they could keep radio watch over anything coming in the direction of the earth. They used the humans that they had grown as slaves. They did all the work and the gardeners just sat back in luxury and told the human slaves what to do. The men and women, perhaps we should call them the supermen and the superwomen, got tired of their own partners, and there were many liaisons which led to bickering and all manner of trouble. But then from outer space and undetected by the pyramid searchers a spaceship appeared. It was a vast ship, and it settled down so that people could come out of it and start to build habitations. The people who were the first on the earth resented the appearance of these other spacemen and women, and so, from a battle of words, there came a battle of people. The trouble went on for some time, and the most devilish inventions were made. At last the people in the big spaceship could not put up with the trouble any longer so they sent out a number of spaceships which apparently were stored ready for such an occasion, and they dropped terrible bombs wherever these other space people were living. The bombs were a very advanced form of atom bomb, and within sight of where the bomb had exploded everything became dead. There was a purple glare coming from the land and the spacemen and women who had caused this got back in their giant spaceship and left the area. For 100 years or more there was hardly any form of life on the earth in the bombed areas, but when the radiation's effects lessened these people crept out in fear and trembling wondering what they would see. They settled down to a form of farming using wooden plows and things like that. "But master," I said, "you say the world is more than 50 million years old. Well, there are such a lot of things I do not understand at all. For instance these men, well, we don't know how old they are, we don't know how many days, weeks, or centuries they have been here, and how can food have been kept fresh all these years? Why didn't the men crumble to dust?" The Lama laughed. "We are an illiterate people, Lobsang. There used to be very much more clever people on this earth. There have been several civilizations, you know. For instance, he pointed to a book on the shelf, this book tells about medical and surgical practices of a type we in Tibet have never even heard of, and we were one of the first people to be put on this earth. Then why are we up so high? Why is our life so hard? Some of those picture books you brought back from Kathmandu show all sorts of things, but we have no knowledge of things like that. We have nothing on wheels in Tibet. No, there is an old saying that when Tibet permits wheels to be brought into the country, then Tibet will be conquered by a very unfriendly race. Their predictions were just as if they could see into the future, and I am going to tell you, young man, that they could see into the future, and they had instruments here which will show you what happened in the past, what is happening now, and what will happen in the future, my guide said. But how can things last so long? If things are left, well, they decay, they fall to pieces, they become useless through disuse, like the prayer wheel in that old lamasery that you showed me, a beautiful piece of work corroded and immovable. How could these people stop things from decaying? How could they provide the power to keep things working? Look at the way the lights come on as soon as we enter a room. We have nothing like that. We use stinking butter candles or rush lights, and yet here we have light which is as good as daylight, and it is not being generated anywhere, because in that book you showed me there were pictures of machines that worked in a magnetic field and generated what you call electricity. We don't have that. Why is it that we are so isolated? I was puzzled. The Lama was silent for a moment, and then he said, "Yes, you will have to know all these things. You are going to be the most educated Lama that there ever was in Tibet. You are going to see the past, the present, and the future. In this particular range of the mountains there are a number of these caves, and at one time they were all joined together by tunnels. It was possible to move from one cave to another and have light and fresh air the whole time, no matter where we were. But this land of Tibet was once down by the sea. People lived on that land with just a very few low hills, and the people of that earlier age had sources of power quite unknown to us. But there came a terrific catastrophe, because beyond our land, scientists of a country called Atlantis let off a tremendous explosive, and that ruined this world." "Ruined this world?" I said. "But our land is all right. How is it ruined? How is the world ruined?" The Lama got up and went to a book. There were such a lot of books here, and he went to a book and found certain pictures. Then he said, "Look, this world once was covered with cloud. There was never a sight of the sun. We knew nothing about the stars. But then in those days people lived hundreds of years, not like now, dying as soon as they have learned anything. People die off now because of the evil radiations from the sun, and because our protecting cloud cover had gone. Then dangerous rays came and saturated the world, bringing all sorts of diseases, all sorts of mental aberrations. The world was in turmoil. The world writhed under the impact of that tremendous explosion. Atlantis, which was a long way from here on the other side of the world, Atlantis sank beneath the ocean. But we of Tibet, well, our land went up 25,000 to 30,000 feet above sea level. People became less healthy, and for a long time people fell dead because there was not enough oxygen at this height for them, and because we were nearer the skies and where we were the radiations were stronger." He stopped for a moment and rubbed his legs, which were paining him a great deal, and then he said, "There is a far part of our land which stayed at sea level, and the people there became more and more different from us. They became almost stupid in their mentality. They had no temples, they did not worship the gods, and even now they go about in skin boats catching seals and fish and other forms of life. There are some immense creatures with enormous horns on their heads, and these people killed many of them and ate their flesh. When other races came along they called these far northern people Eskimos. Our part of Tibet had the best people, priests, and wise men, and doctors of great renown, and the part which was sheared away from Tibet and sank to sea level, or rather, stayed at sea level, had the lesser mentalities, the ordinary workers, the ordinary people, the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. They have remained in almost the same state for more than a million years. They gradually crept out and set about making a living on the surface of the earth. They set up small farms and within 100 or so years things appeared to be normal and settled down. Before we go any further in our discussions, I will ask you to look at my legs. They are paining me a great deal, and I have a book here which shows wounds something like mine.